Hello and welcome back to Core Ideas, the podcast where we delve into anything related to lake sediments and paleolimnology. As always, we are your hosts. My name is Josh Theenpont, and I'm here with my good friend, Adam Jeziorski.
How's it going?
Not too bad. What's up?
Not too much. We're in the depths of winter and cold snaps here in lovely southern Ontario.
Yeah, it's been a while since we recorded one of these things.
Yeah.
Even though we've been putting them out slow, like the from when we're recording this, one was uploaded not too long ago, and there'll be another one in the intervening time. But yeah, it's. I was listening as I was editing the last bit before I put it up, and we were talking about, you know, going into the new term and being on campus, and that just got wiped away. So we got to stop talking about the pandemic, because by the time we get these things posted, everything has changed.
I know. We'll be on, the Omega wave.
Yep. Yeah. Wave 12 or whatever it is. Anyway, happily, the podcast continues to roll on. We're quickly approaching year two's celebration.
I know. And I don't know what exactly we'll celebrate. Not been quite as active in year two as we were in year one, but pretty excited to be starting a new arc. And I guess we're already one episode into it, looking into what we're calling conceptual rabbit holes, or ideas that are simple on the surface, but more complex to dig deep into them. And there's lots of them in paleolimnology. And just, as a recap for last time, we looked at what exactly is being reconstructed in paleolimnological reconstruction, or how it is a wiggly world out there. And not sure I really answered any questions regarding how easy it is or not to match the paleolimnological and direct monitoring data, but I thought it was, spending some time talking about the advantages and disadvantages of linking these different types of records and how it can be complicated was a pretty interesting start to a new series of topics.
Oh, agreed. I think it was a good place to start, and lots of places we could jump off from there. I don't know that there's a natural progression from that to the things we were considering, but lots of different topics in this conceptual rabbit hole, big picture sort of arc.
Yeah, I think it's a grab bag of ideas to contrast with the very detailed views of individual paleo indicators, whereas now we're talking more of a 40,000 foot view and looking at different things. And where to go next?
Among the things that we talked about, and we will get to it, is thinking about other, I don't mean just in this episode, I mean, there's a couple of ideas that are related to this. And it kind of goes along with the idea of the monitoring versus paleo data, but is to think about other types of records, whether they be monitoring, like we talked about last time, or whether they be other examples of archival types of data. So I think that is the thing we will do this time. We're going to expand our horizons and completely leave the lakes behind. We're not even going to talk about lakes. We're not going to talk about wetlands. We're going to talk about something totally different. Yes, that's right, dear listeners. Despite being a paleolimnology podcast.
The paleolimnology podcast.
Is it? Yeah, I guess so. Yeah. Okay. Sorry. The paleolimnology
podcast. There are still no others 2 years down
there. There are. Yeah.
We own this niche.
We saturated the market at like 25 listens a week. Anyway, we're going to go off-road and explore other examples of archives that are used to reconstruct past environments that aren't lakes. And there are lots of them.
Yeah. And basically, lakes are of broad interest because there are lots of them. And they're all over the globe. And but really, what it comes down to, they're a natural archive that the sediments are preserved from disturbance. But really, any sort of natural deposit that records a historical sequence of events can be interpreted, with the appropriate knowledge.
Yeah. At some point in the past, I don't remember which episode, in the 40, is this 40? Yeah.
This wow, is number 40. 40.
Crazy. In that record of episodes, we talked about Steno's principle, or the principle of superposition. So those are like the, they're not laws of geology.
That would have been in the sense, history series.
Was it? Yeah. Okay. That makes sense. And so as long as there is some sort of depositional environment, and it's not even that required to be, you know, horizontally deposited like we assume in geology in superposition. But if you take that away, that gets the idea across. That as long as there is some depositional nature to the record, and basically as long as you have a good understanding of where in the record the old stuff is relative to the young stuff, and that doesn't change over time, or it changes in a way that you can understand and use, so it folds or whatever, that could potentially be a useful archive. And it's amazing as you start to go through the list of things that people have done to reconstruct the environment and see some of the fairly at the outset when they first came up with this idea, probably crazy ideas as to what you can look at.
Yeah. And, you know, there are lots of these sorts of archives that are out there, and, you know, lots of them have been studied, and probably lots of them are still remain to be discovered. But, you know, this covers inorganic things like ice cores and speleotherms and ice wedges. Some of them are looking at growth patterns of individual organisms, and so that's where you get into things like dendrochronology and tree ring analyses and sclerochronology. And then there's also the whole category of natural deposits created by animals, so not just lake sediments, but in principle the same general sort of idea, but talking about things like guano mounds, middens, nesting sites, and a variety of natural deposits.
Yeah. And it probably seemed a little bit crazy to go and take a core of lake mud at some point too. So it just as the first person to go and take a big slice out of a pack rat midden and look at all the stuff that they'd picked up, probably got a few strange looks, and then lo and behold, these are amazing archives, as they all are.
I think there's levels of craziness, though. There's a little bit difference between taking
that's fair.
A sediment core from, you know, some mud from the bottom of a lake versus, digging into a several-story pile of bat poop that is hundreds of thousands of years old looking for treasure.
Fair enough. Point taken.
But to each their own.
And in as we'll talk about, in many locations, that is the only option. So if you can find this natural deposit and you can interpret it, then that can tell you something about the environment.
And in terms of like the wide variety of natural archives that are out there in the world, one key element to the hunt for many of these archives is because in many locations, particularly like arid locations, there just aren't very many lakes or wetlands available archiving the local environment. And so it becomes like a bit of a quest to find alternate means to find long-term environmental change on the landscape.
Yeah, we take this for granted for sure. It was something that comes up all the time in classes when you're teaching students in Southern Ontario, where I'm talking about, probably Canada in general, Northeastern United States, whatever, take for granted that there is standing water
everywhere.
Just everywhere. Yeah. And that is not the case in the vast majority of the planet. It's going to be dry. It's going to be stream dominated. So it's just not standing water, depositional and basins. And in those areas, you still need to understand what's been going on over long timescales in order to understand even modern changes. So the need to identify these indicators and these archives persists and has to get creative.
And on top of that, a key element of this whole kind of topic is that not every archive will record the same environmental changes. And this is because in many ways, unlike lakes, which are a depositional basin for a huge suite of indicators. So, you know, we've gone through this in like previous arcs, but you have an autochthonous stuff. So stuff generated within the lake, stuff from around the lake, multiple trophic levels, leaving a record in the sediments. A lot of the other archives that we referred to earlier, and we'll be talking about in some more detail in the next few minutes, are often, or it's not that they are only indicators of one things, but they're only really used, I guess, to indicate one or two things, just in terms of the level of understanding and exactly what has been recorded in that particular archive can be quite specific.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. They do tend to be a little bit more specific. And that may be that the method just hasn't been pushed any further to develop them as indicators of X or Y, because they were identified to reconstruct a condition related to one thing, and that worked out. That satisfied the requirement in order to do that, and so it wasn't pushed any further. And or some of them are biological, and so, you know, you have the constraints of the biology of the organism. You're not going to be able to, you know, reconstruct something from a tree ring that has no linkage to the biology of a tree growing in a given location. So they can be constrained by the nature of the archive, not just being this bowl that's collecting everything that preserves, but everything from in and out of the lake into one area.
Yeah. And then, and many of the examples that are of these kind of, like, I guess, so even the way that we refer to them doesn't totally make sense, because we talk about it often as like unconventional paleolimnology, but there's no actual limnology in it. It's like environmental archives. But basically using paleolimnological techniques for things other than lake sediments, I guess, would be one way to kind of wrap your brain around it. But they broadly often fall into the, like, the discipline of paleoclimatic archives. And this often makes a lot of sense, because there's a broad interest in reconstructing climate. And, you know, it's like we have the general crisis affecting the globe over the past few decades, prompting scientists and researchers to go to ever increasing amounts of effort to find indicators from more and more regions of varying specificity. When they're first, as we alluded to earlier, maybe there's no lakes in the area that they're trying to get a good read on. And maybe their second or third choices, whatever they might be, may not be present either. And so then it becomes okay, but what is being recorded through time in this particular region?
Yeah, I find it fascinating that in almost every location, there is something that is archiving a record of climate in particular. Maybe some of the other things we've talked about throughout all of these podcast episodes less so, but from a climate perspective, it seems, going through this list and thinking about them, that there's generally something nearby, and that includes going into the marine environment, which we never really talk about, because this is a lake show. The lake show, right? Of course. Sorry, it's twice now. So if there's no lakes, and maybe there's no trees, or the trees are not recording that, because trees can be complicated, and what is it that's controlling their growth? May not be temperature. It may be more precipitation. It may be more local factors. What else can be found? And then when that does. When you do find the archive of something that's recording a history that's building up, what is it that you're actually going to look at when you're analyzing it? Is it going to be fossil evidence like diatoms or cladocerons or something like that? Is it going to be isotope evidence like you would with the stable isotopes we talked about a couple episodes ago, and then also that are important for ice cores and tree rings, the kind of things we used as examples. So that's the second part, is to pull that, I guess, indicator out of the archive.
Yeah. And so, you know, and these isotopes are being recorded by things like the cellulose and tree rings, the calcium carbonate and speleotherms, and biological organisms like coral reefs or mollusks that are being preserved. And they can use it in a similar manner because they're recording the oxygen isotopes present at the time of their formation. And then when they pile up grow, you're getting that record through time. And if those remains are left undisturbed, then they're an archive that can be mined metaphorically. But it is also very important to keep in mind the environmental context of the specific archive, because the conditions under which a coral grows and the behavior of the isotopes within it will be quite different in, you know, potentially tropical marine environment versus on top of a glacial ice sheet.
Oh, absolutely, for sure. And there's so many things that you can use these isotopic remains, isotopic indicators in from organisms. And there is a linkage to when you were talking about corals and mollusks and like animals, to sort of an archaeology perspective as well, a paleontology perspective, because there's been work on like looking at mammoth tusks, and it's amazing, I guess, to sum it up, that so many organisms have growth rings of some sort, where they're recording a temporal component in some sort of structure that they have, you know, fish otoliths,
which
we talk about from a lake perspective, we talk about those. But mammoth tusks and, you know, it's amazing. You can continue to find all of these different things. And I think that links into, when you're talking about whole or individual organisms or parts of organisms, links into the potential to use archives that are created by biological organisms, but are not made up of the animals themselves.
Yeah. And so there are a number of organisms that, you know, leave material behind. And those materials can be used for paleoclimate reconstructions too. As an indirect record, one of the most studied types of these records would be pack rat mittens. And so this is basically, for those not familiar, pack rats are basically a genus of rodent. They actually mice, even though they're called pack rats.
I'm not sure where rodent breakdown. I think they're closer to us, like the smaller rats of North America, than like field mice, kind of like native mice. But don't quote me on that. That's like a line from Wikipedia way back.
Yeah, no, we're out of our lane a little bit here. But basically, the point, we don't really care too much about the animals.
They're quite
themselves.
Cute little things.
Well, I don't know.
I think, you don't care. I think they're sweet little things.
But anyway, but the point being that they, you know, they have nests, and the refuse and the waste from the animals piles up over time, and that poop and food remains and whatever else they accumulate in their middens leaves an archive that piles up over years and can be examined in detail. But the deeper you get, the older you get, kind of mentality.
Yeah, I think they're like fascinating and hilarious all at the same time. Like, apparently they have a predilection for shiny things. So if you go now up and find a modern mitten, it'll just be full of buttons and seeds that the little thing liked, and they're like collectors. Someone, I don't know, was it John who said they're like Smaug from The Hobbit? Like, they just sit on their little treasure troves of things that they've collected without the like dragon activities. And yeah, so they collect things, and now they collect buttons and, you know, little bits of,
you know, go
fluff and tinsel and things like that.
Get like ring pull tabs.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Like, oh, we're in the 70s
you definitely
now.
Would. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, exactly. And then you go further back. They still like to collect stuff, but there weren't people around. So they collected seeds and twigs and, you know, the plant pieces and stuff like that. And so when they do that and bring them into these mounds, which can be enormous, like as big as grown adults can climb into these things or crawl into them, because they're often like in underhangs of arid regions, in particular where they're really popularly used in the southwestern United States, in Arizona and those kind of areas. They can be enormous archives, and they produce a really viscous urine, apparently. That's
Getting better, this story.
Yeah, right. So they pee all over the mitten, right? And that becomes the glue that holds it all together and preserves all of these things. So you get incredibly well-preserved plant remains that can be used to track the biogeography of plants that were found in areas going back. There are pack rat mittens that go past like deep into the Quaternary, like past the last glacial, because there's no glaciation in these areas either, right? So there's nothing to wipe them away like our lakes. And so we have these long-term climate trends inferred indirectly, often from like this plant species is no longer found in this area, not found here now. We know it's in an area of colder climate. So this area was likely colder when the silly little rodent moved these seeds here and then peed all over them.
Just as an aside, I just like the general idea that the secret ingredient or the magic ingredient to pack rat mittens is very viscous urine. But and because in these can be found in like desert areas, they're often the best, if not the only, paleoclimate record available for some regions, and which gives them a huge significance. And the genus of pack rats is Neotoma, which may be a familiar word to many, some of our listeners, because that is the name of the big paleoecological database,
which is did we mention it in the pollen episode? Maybe,
possibly.
If not, if we didn't mention it by name, we mentioned it by existence, because there are these databases of paleoecological data, and it's named after pack rats.
Yeah. And then just going further into like the
I could talk about pack rats all day. Like, we should have just made this a pack.
Well, it's not really episode about pack rats. It's more about poop. And it's just like
I think they're funny. You
know, the juvenile person within me is just like, you know, that pack rat poop size. So the individual pellets, droppings, can tell you something about climate just on their own.
Mm-hmm. Amazing.
Just because the pellet size is proportional to the size of the rat that produced it, and
which should make sense. Anyone who's looked at dogs knows that that's just reasonable.
It makes sense. And in turn, the size of the animal is linked to temperature, with warmer regions and warmer times having smaller pack rats.
Yep. That's the classic example of Bergman's rule. You know, colder regions, you get bigger animals. Like if you look at bears, polar bears are the biggest, and they get smaller as you go into warmer areas. And it works for within a genus or within a species too. So the same rat or same lineage of rat will change its body size to suit the temperature, to suit the climate.
And
fascinating.
Its poop pellet size will also change.
That's exactly it. Yep. And because it's desiccated and it's in a dry area, you know, that adds to the preservation. It makes it so that these archives are the only option, because some of the others don't exist. No trees, no lakes, but it does help with the preservation of the pack rat mitten.
It's magical, really. And on that note, everybody poops. Everything poops, and that means that there are other piles of poop out there in the world that can be studied.
Yep, that's right. Just keep looking. Someone's like, hey, if the pack rat people can do it, so can we. That was the bat researchers.
but to be fair, you would have thought that it'd be the other way around. Because like some of the cave bat poop piles are awe-inspiring.
Oh, and known since antiquity. You know, they're not new things. People have known about these, and they are massive. You know, some of the things you see on Planet Earth and those kind of documentary shows of large cave dwelling bat colonies are enormous
and conducive to being preserved. So if you're in bat colony in a cave for a long, long time, they're up on the cave ceiling, pooping down into a giant pile below them. That poop pile is not regularly disturbed. It's kept relatively dry. And these are
probably anoxic too.
Just, magical. And, again, so here rather than deserts, we're really talking more about tropical locations, which often, despite being wet, don't typically have a lot of lakes to present as archives. So basically, if you're interested in long-term ecological records, you're forced to look at other things. And so digging deep, deep, deep into ginormous piles of bat guano is a thing.
Yeah, for sure. And the harder to get to, probably the better archives they are. They'd be less disturbed. But that's becomes a mountaineering or a spelunking, but a really challenging kind of access
and
getting equipment in there. Yeah, poopineering, sure. patent pending on that term. And that should be on a t-shirt. And you get a very different environmental cue. And I'm not sure that there are sort of the same paleoclimatic records that have been used, and correct me if I'm wrong, I certainly don't know everything about bat guanoology, but being poop, you're going to have obviously nitrogen. So the nitrogen isotopes, like we talked about from the productivity perspective, are definitely going to be part of that signal. There's a lot of contaminants because bats feed at a different bat species feed at a variety of different trophic levels. So you would imagine the ones that are insectivores are going to, integrate different food, integrate different nitrogen, but also integrate different contaminants from the frugivores. I don't know that carnivorous bats roost in large caves. I don't think like vampire bats are found in huge concentrations, But, you're going to get that contaminant perspective. You're going to get the remains of the bits that they ate and defecated out. So the seeds of fruit that often pass through organisms, the remains of insects, obviously the chitinized bits that don't digest well. So it's just going to be literally a slurry of paleo goodness in there.
And although, in terms of like many of the things that we've spoken about that I've had no direct experience in and go, I would have really liked to have tried that one time. The bat cave things in the tropics, it's hot and humid beside a, 10 story tall pile of poo. It's just
that you had to belay down into it, cave wearing a respirator. Yeah.
And it's nothing but respect for the people that do it, but I don't see the appeal.
Yeah, anyone who complains about wearing their mask all day has not sampled a bat poo in a tropical cave wearing a full hazmat suit and respirator. You'll be all right.
So the masks don't work. I can't breathe with the mask.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So, that does seem like very hardcore paleo environmental research. Having seen some pictures.
But if that is too harsh for you, but you still have an acute interest in paleo poop analyses, you don't have to go quite so far afield or to quite so harsh an environment. Because in temperate regions, there are simpler or easier archives out there if you're interested. If, you know, poop piles are your thing, it is likely because you have a specific interest in what produced it. And one of the things that produces serious poop piles not too far from where I'm sitting is chimney swifts. Would be an example of a, I guess, what would it be? An organism that leaves poop indicators spotted across the landscape, because there are a species of bird that actually flourished in many regions where humans built, I guess, not necessarily buildings, but I guess
structures that were roosting sites for them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so you have these basically abandoned chimneys in older buildings where you've got a colony of them roosting for an extended period of time. And one of those archives is, you know, was fairly well documented and publicized just at Queen's University in Kingston, I guess. About 10 years ago now is when the chimney...
Something like that. Yeah, maybe. Yeah, something in that range. Yeah, they're an interesting little bird when you read up a little on them. They're, I don't know if they're nocturnal or just like crepuscular or whatever, but they hole up in places for most of the day. And historically, they weren't that common in southern, whatever, southeastern Ontario, the northeastern United States, but they flourished when people started building chimneys because that was a nice analog to a like tree cavity that they would historically have found themselves in.
Except bigger
and more numerous and everywhere. And they just had this huge explosion in their populations. And then we stopped, you know, using them so commonly. Chimneys, they're still on houses, but they're not the big ones that heated factories and buildings like industrial locations. Kind of stopped quite quickly when we moved to centralized electricity. And some of those obviously got knocked down and the huge poop piles probably with them. But the few that remained are quite interesting archives of the lives of one particular species that's now, I don't know if it's fully threatened or what its status is, but it's in decline. And you get the work at Queen's on this one chimney from Fleming Hall. Is that where your office is supposed to be?
I've only been there twice, yeah. But yes.
Cool. Was one of those kind of cool examples where it had been covered up so that it didn't get washed away or whatever, and then reopened again. And then some of the researchers in the small lab group and colleagues elsewhere thought, hey, this is a cool way to look at a bunch of different stuff.
Yeah. So depending on what your interest is, between the tropics and temperate regions, marine environments, trees, there's natural archives all over the place, and our natural deposits that can be used as archives all over the place. And, you know, you're not limited to studying lakes and, you know, for many of these sort of environmental questions I've been talking about over the course of the last 40-ish episodes. It's just like one aspect, I guess, of environmental reconstructions.
Yep. I wonder if there's a Pack Rat Midden podcast.
I have to Google it. Watch there be in it and be like have a massive kind of listener base. Let me draw the ire of the Pack Rat Midden fans by not mocking them, but just in our general tone of like the lack of I guess.
Are you deference. Kidding? I would have an archive of back episodes to work through.
So, having, you know, being tangentially connected to some of these sort of analyses in our time at Queen's, have you had any personal experiences with more dryish archives, one way to talk about it?
I don't think so. I get, we talked about being tree ring adjacent in the isotope lecture. So that would be, I think, it. And we talked a little bit about ice wedges and, know about that, but that's not personal stuff. So no, not really. Pretty much a lake person. They're very interesting for sure. But I guess, when you get specialized I would wonder how much crossover there is from people who work on several different things. I would imagine that you get more and more specialized when you get into some of these.
Yeah, because I guess you become an you're forced to become your expertise is, indicator specific, I guess. We talked before, there's not a whole lot of, what are they called? Polymaths out there that are familiar with every indicator. It's usually you've got the time to really focus on just a small handful. Yeah. And so in this.
Yeah. The glaciologist gets everything they need from the ice core. It's really centered around using that for something specific. And that makes sense for the same with someone who works on corals or.
So yeah, and I am in the same boat. I have no personal experience with any of the feces, but I have been feces adjacent at many points in my life.
That's right. Did you share an office with Angelo when he was helping take those samples from the chimney in Fleming Hall?
What's interesting though is I'm pretty sure that because he went on to do lake analyses for his actual theses.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So he collected.
Oh, I think he was just there for the day.
Yeah. The Chimney Swift course, but I don't think he analyzed them.
No. I think he would just come in. Hopefully he went straight home to the shower. Not came into the office in his scrubs or whatever he was wearing.
No, he came in as a volunteer and, got put to work in the chimneys in several stories of dried poop and thought, this is for me. So,
sounds like a Dickens novel, doesn't it? So there you go. I guess we are really just talking pretty generally, no personal experience, but
par for the course.
In
really.
Another world, if you went and studied somewhere else, yeah.
And I guess one other thing that just kind of as we were preparing the notes for this episode is, would you slot Pete into this group? Pete analyses, because it's like dry, it's very specific to the immediate location in many ways.
Yes. True.
It's closer to solid versus lake sediment. Yeah. So you're dealing.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I think it's maybe somewhere in between. You're using lakes, you're using coring techniques. Pretty similar to what you would use in a lake. Not that you don't core a tree or ice or a coral, but they're very different. Whereas you would use like a Russian corer, which you could use on lakes. Some of the indicators are lake indicators or aquatic indicators or semi-aquatic, diatoms, protozoans, testate amoeba. But it is, you're right, it is quite different. It is quite local. Yeah.
So.
I don't know. It's good to think about.
Yeah, throw it out there. I guess everything is a spectrum in terms of, I guess they're all individual kind of archives, but there's like a range and some are more similar. Obviously, the poop piles are quite similar to each other. But then as you go to from the more dryish to the wettish kind of environments, that is just a gradual gradation, really.
Yeah, and some of them I know very little about. We just hinted at speleotherms, so like cave stalactites and stalagmites. I don't know anything about the methodology behind those. I mean, I basically know that they look at carbon isotopes, oxygen isotopes, because they're carbon, because of what they're made out of. But Yeah, I don't know anything about how you would take one of those things. Do they cut the whole thing off and section it?
No idea.
Something to look up for another day.
Absolutely no idea. That's well outside of my lane. But just, I know they exist. I've seen the word several times. I've seen them in lists of things and textbooks, but that'd be the extent of my direct connection.
Have you been in caves with speleotherms, with stalagmites?
I don't know. I'm like trying to think. I don't think I've ever been in a real cave, like in a cave system type.
Mm-hmm.
I've never spelunked.
On like vacation. No, no. There were stairs. This cave in Bermuda that I have in my mind, but yeah, they are pretty cool. And again, in those kind of places, cool solution to a problem.
Yeah, I guess. And I've got some like low level claustrophobia to the point that I just don't find even in the touristy level caves. I just have no interest in actually visiting.
Yeah, they're pretty cool, but I can see how if you didn't like that would be maybe take some of the joy out of it. And then the last thing that when we were thinking about this, we were considering is the value that some of these archives have. And I hinted at a little bit when I said that people have known about bat guano and piles of bat guano since antiquity, because it's not very often that we think of lake mud as being valuable or being particularly rare or being all that much useful for anything else. But that's not the case with, like, in particular, guano.
Yeah, because it has, I guess industrial is not necessarily the right word, but maybe. But as broad use as fertilizer. My imagining things here, is it also not a key element of like gunpowder at one point?
Guano that sounds mines? Familiar. I don't know. Familiar.
We didn't talk about this when we put it on those, but it's just like coming to me again. For some reason I remember in terms of like, you know, like conquistadors and muskets and like the back guano caves having a large strategic value for as a gunpowder resource in some way or shape. But anyways, because just the concentration of nitrogen and phosphorus in these localized deposits have led to them being mined, and compared to lake sediments, they are much more accessible. Like even the remote bat cave piles, you know, the bats have to be able to get in there. The bats are of a certain size, so many of them, they're much more accessible, so that means in many ways they're much more vulnerable than lake archives often are. Like, yes, you hear stories like the, you know, the Arctic ponds drying and the which cape is it? Cape Herschel, that the Arctic ponds have dried over the last couple of decades on. So yes, and lake and the glaciation wiping lake records away. But on a more localized level, where the value is seen, a lot of these environmental archives can be wiped out with a purpose.
Yeah, and trees would fit into that in some way too. Obviously, there are more trees, but older trees become really important parts of a chronology because they extend it back, but also they have the greatest amount of potential for timber or whatever is going to be used for it. And so you get that same analogous sort of relationship with the value of preserving some of these archives.
Yeah. So, yeah, no, it's an interesting topic overall and for many aspects in terms of what they are, where they are, and how many of them remain and how they vary across the globe.
And the potential for poop, which is always very high.
And I will always dive into those head first.
That's right.
All right then. So I think that's a good place to end our, episode looking at the next best thing since sliced sediment. And once again, thank you for listening to Core Ideas, the podcast dedicated to all things paleolimnology. If you'd like to reach out to us with a question or comment, just send us an email to coreideaspodcast@gmail.com.
Or contact us through Twitter @coreideaspaleo, and there's only one A in paleo.
All of our past episodes and some of the corresponding show notes would normally be found on our website at coreideas.ajzierski.ca, but we are currently experiencing some technical difficulties, so you may want to check back later.
Did you notice? Dear listener.
Good old migrations going awry, alas. We'll fix it soon.
That's the world. Yeah, and maybe it'll be ready by the time this comes out and you'll be like, oh, it looks fine. And if you're so inclined, you can give us a rating or subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, SoundCloud, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Those 5-star ratings make us feel really great. But to be honest, we don't care all that much because we just do this for fun.
And that's it for now. So join us again next time as we continue to explore paleolimnology in the knowledge economy era, sticking to our ethos of pure knowledge without the economy. Unless... is being mined for good enough.